Welcome to the School Sucks Project,
a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community
dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes,
relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show
and subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast.
Dude, bro! Bro! I went online to read a news story about immigrants being discriminated against.
Yeah?
Well, and so I clicked on the headline, but it turned out to be an ad for Ready Whip. So then I clicked on the X button to make it go away, but then it was a link to another ad. And when I tried to cancel that, another window came up and it was this.
We live in an age where everything is staged, where all we do is fake our feelings. I've been scared to put myself so out there. Time is running out, yeah. Need to let you know that last night I woke the fuck up.
If you ask these people what's good about diversity, what's good about inclusion, their heads just explode. They do not know the answer. But they do know that it doesn't apply to traditionally privileged groups. The groups they see as true, well, fuck them. We don't mean include. All inclusion is good. All diversity is good, but not for those people. Not the diversity of their ideas or their needs. So it's just the plot is completely lost on this. And I thought, you know, unless Gillette, which I think I am suspicious that it was to have that viral outrage appeal. But if it was with good intentions, just based on these faulty premises, I mean, that's a sign of the times of how bad things have actually gotten. Right, where there's no precision in language with this anymore at all. So if these marketing departments are by and large populated today by these kids that you're interacting with in these clubhouse meetings, great. There's still people above them looking at bottom lines going, yeah, go out there with your dumb ideas and stir some shit to help our bottom line. You know, I think those two things could definitely work together.
Well, and what I've seen is a lot of times especially now it's not just Clubhouse. I work with a lot of, over the last 5 years, I've worked with marketing departments from everywhere from Sirius Satellite Radio to multinational companies that I'm not even allowed to say who they are, but I've worked with some very big companies and I've seen this permeate and kind of work its way into the marketing departments across the board. But now what I'm starting to see is where this is kind of like, it's almost done as a tax. It's the marketing that we know works that goes after this, but we also have the marketing we basically lose money on, the get woke, go broke marketing. We're gonna do it because we're gonna appease the people that will come after us and attack us if we don't. We spend 70% of our advertising on what we know works, and we spend 30% of our advertising deliberately on something that we know doesn't work just to appease the religious fanatics or the tax collectors.
I hear the axe swinging. I hear the axe swinging band. I hear the axe swinging. I hear the axe swinging band.
The earth burned dark for 5 days. The little children sprouted wings.
Canine appetite, roaming lion, and many more. Don't scrape the rind off. Wound up, bound the van like a snowman. Throw away the shoulder.
All right, everyone, listen up. In order for better understanding, we've asked students of Canadian origin to introduce you to their culture, and hey, Leslie, shut your fucking mouth!
Do you like our school, Jimmy?
Yes, Leslie, I like our school very much.
I like our school, too.
I like the kids who go there.
I'm starting to wonder something about you, Leslie.
I'm starting to wonder about you. I mean, you seem like a nice kid, but don't you feel like you could be happier?
Holy shit.
What?
Can you excuse me for a moment?
Okay.
Well, Jimmy, what do you think?
Does she know she's an ad?
He can't spot them.
Does she know she's an ad? Leslie, what kind of plans do you have? Do you have any plans?
What kind of plans?
Just, you know, plans. Like, what are you hoping to accomplish?
I don't know. What are your plans?
You have the wrong idea about me, Jimmy. The person trying to change things and make everything terrible is the new principal.
And what is the new principal trying to do, Leslie?
He's trying to make sure people like you and me aren't allowed to exist. can't just hide, Kyle. We have to let people know PC is the enemy before it's too late.
Leslie, we don't know who is on their side. We have to stay safe.
The principal is going to try and make up some crazy story. That's what PC people do. You have to get in front of everyone and tell them what you've learned.
Every time you block us, we get smarter. Every time you try to stop us, we are more. If one plan fails, we will plan another. You will never be rid of ads.
Hey, Leslie! Your species took PC and twisted it for evil purposes. That pisses me off! You're expelled.
So we're going to be talking about what you introduced to me is woke advertising.
Mm-hmm. Kind of virtue signal advertising. It's more and more popular. We'll talk about why it's kind of seen an increase in popularity over the last couple of years. At first, it was kind of like people would joke about it. Like they'd do the roundup of the stupid man advertising where like the woman's so smart, she's an astronaut, and the guy's so dumb that he locks his keys in the car and he has to call her in outer space to get her to unlock his car for him because men are stupid.
Cockmercials, they've been called. Yeah, I just saw this news article today, and I didn't have Facebook, thank God, because I would have gone on there and posted something shitty about this dad who got arrested for referring to his 14-year-old transgender daughter as she, or son, who was a daughter as she. And I was just like, this has happened in Canada. I mean, not in the United States, not yet. And I was just like, oh, this guy hasn't been watching enough American advertising and sitcoms, because if he had, he'd know that he's just supposed to be kind of a dim-witted nuisance in the background of his family as his enlightened daughters and wife begrudgingly tolerate him. That's kind of a lot of the messaging about the value of dads in the American culture through media. And this is something that, yeah, a lot of people have observed over. I mean, you can take this back to the origin of Homer Simpson, but that model, I think, for more than just comedy, has been facsimiled for a good 20 years now in a lot of especially like comedy entertainment.
Mm-hmm. And it goes further than that.
Oh, it does. Yeah.
There's the make your profile a blacked out image, or make your profile a rainbow flag image during this month. Or there's all these different ways to virtue signal in your marketing. Having, well, I think it was Kylie Jenner, maybe one of them, come out with a Pepsi and hand it to a police officer in the middle of a protest, which backfired. A lot of times the stuff backfires. I think it's kind of the idea that what the kids are into is social justice. So we need to implement social justice narratives into our marketing. It started out kind of toes in the water, but now it's at the point where we're drowning in it in a lot of aspects.
I think we are also going to be exploring and possibly, maybe not, but possibly disagreeing on what does it mean exactly to backfire. Right. If you think about what the purpose of advertising is, or branding is, and you know what it is, are these things really backfiring? Like, yeah, the Pepsi thing was ugly. That was 2017, where they're basically doing like this generic version of a Black Lives Matter rally. And then Kendall Jenner struts through and gives one of the riot cops a Pepsi as if it's some kind of elixir of tolerance. And everybody cheers. You know, there was outrage about, oh, this downplays BLM and all that. But Pepsi wasn't really hurt by it, bottom line wise. And there's lots of examples of that that we could talk about. Pepsi was following suit from Coke. Coke ran an ad in like 1971, which I think was like, I'd like to buy the world a Coke or something like that, based on I'd like to teach the world to sing. Mm-hmm. And it was like this very multicultural crowd of people sharing a Coke and singing and being chummy with each other. But in 1971, that was just a good message, right? Like, hey, world, let's get along. There was nothing political really about a multicultural America in 1971. But when Coke did the same thing in 2014, in like the opening shots of the social justice war, it was just outrage. And we forget, too, like when you look at woke advertising, you remember how much snowflakery there is on the right. You know, the people always pointing the fingers at the left, like they're the ones who wind up boycotting and burning things in a lot of these like woke advertising campaign responses. So I'm sure we'll talk more about that today, too.
Yeah. And as an example of that, I remember the Colin Kaepernick kneeling for the flag and Nike signing him. And
this was the best. Yeah, I love
it. A lot of people went out and burnt their Nike shoes and did like TikTok videos or YouTube videos of them setting. I think it was YouTube because TikTok wasn't a thing then, but setting their shoe, their Nikes on fire. So, yeah, there's definitely the snowflakery, as you said, on both ends.
Yeah. And we'll tease it for now, but we'll talk about the outcome of these campaigns, too, for Pepsi, Coke, Nike, I think further along in the conversation. But you actually wanted to start today talking about some experience that you've been having on Clubhouse.
Yeah, you're not on Clubhouse yet, are you?
It's an Apple thing, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not.
Yeah. So I got conned. My stepdaughter conned me into buying an iPhone when my last phone crapped out. So I did get Clubhouse and I have been exploring Clubhouse. I'm not nearly as enthusiastic about it as most people are. I've sat in on some good calls. I've sat in on a lot of really garbage, waste of time calls. And right before Valentine's Day, one of the calls that was recommended to me was inclusivity in advertising for Valentine's Day. And it was a call with a bunch of fresh newbie right out of college marketers, people who had just gotten their marketing degrees. They all sounded like they were in their early 20s. A lot of them, when they joined, they said, "Hi, my name's whatever. My pronouns are whatever." There was a lot of that going on. And the whole point of the call, it was somebody that was the marketing director for Jared Diamond Diamonds and another diamond company. And they were talking about how they were the two leaders of the call. And then a bunch of other people were jumping in. And the whole point was, how do we make our marketing more inclusive? Because most advertising, especially for Valentine's Day, is for heteronormative couples. And they didn't want to offend lesbian couples because lesbians like diamonds too. And so it shouldn't just be a him gift for her. It should be also a her gift for her. And then there was, well, how do we make sure that we don't offend transgender people? And it just went in all these different directions about how they could make their advertising more inclusive, how they could not alienate segments of the market, and how they could advertise to everybody. Everybody who might be celebrating Valentine's Day needs to be advertised to in a single campaign. Totally. It was so much cringe, but by the end of the call, I was so frustrated with all the bad advice. And then it got me thinking about how much this mentality, not just the inclusivity, but like the social justice narrative has just, like I said earlier, it was originally just kind of a toes in the water thing, but now we're neck deep in it. And it's infiltrated almost all the big giant marketing departments of these giant, all these giant marketing firms. It's everywhere now. And hearing them talk about how it was such a great thing and me knowing how it's going to impact the sales was a little bit, it was just cringe. And I wanted to talk about it on this week's episode.
Ooh, I'm intrigued by you saying how it's going to impact the sales. And that might be where we see this a little bit differently, because I'm looking at a lot of the stuff that's going on and thinking it's kind of genius, even though it is very unbearable. Now, can you think of any highlights that you heard on there? Did anything really stick out to you that was introduced or suggested on this call about Valentine's Day?
Yeah, specifically, like I said, it was two reps that were the marketing advisors for two different diamond companies. And the main thing that they were trying to get across is that biological females aren't the only ones that want diamonds. The other thing was same-sex couples, not to exclude same-sex couples. And then they started getting into, well, how do we make sure that guys are buying diamonds for guys? And for me, the main problem that I was having with it. There was a couple of main problems, and we'll get into them, that I have with it. But for me, it's kind of the thing of know who your target market is and try and sell to them, and don't try to sell to people who aren't your target. Don't try and convince other people who aren't your target market to buy your product. If you're selling Advil, don't try and convince someone who's never had a headache before that they should buy your product. A lot of the COVID-19 vaccine discussion that's going on is like, how do we convince people who don't want to buy it to buy it? And to me as a marketer, I'm just like, you don't waste your time and your advertising dollars going after people who aren't your target market. If you've got a war chest of funds to go after them, then maybe that's a different story. But for the average business owner out there, market to the people with a headache. If you're selling Advil, don't market to the people who have never had a headache. And for this particular conversation, a lot of it was, well, how do we convince guys to buy diamonds for their boyfriend who doesn't care about diamonds? And it was just like, you don't. But that was lost on him.
I'm getting real suspicious here. So just so I understand this, these two guys who were the ad execs or managed these accounts for these companies, they introduced this topic. Oh, shit. Okay. And did they know? Can you figure out anything about who the participants on the Clubhouse chat are going to be?
No, but it was you schedule Clubhouse events in advance, and you schedule, as part of the scheduling, you let people know what it is that the goal of the call is going to be to kind of entice them. So they knew what the agenda for the call was before they even agreed to get on.
Okay. So that draws in a certain type of crowd. Mm-hmm. Now, I see this as kind of, you know, this could be cynical, this could be conspiratorial, as kind of exploitatious. These guys, now this is a theory, again, this is a theory. These guys set this up to generate ideas, not for how to get guys to buy other guys' diamonds, but to get from these young people who would be attracted to a call like this, ideas that will make people like me or you or the people listening to this show fucking furious. It's one step short of going to 4chan. It's one step short of going to 4chan, I would say. Now, I'll build that out as we talk on, but that's a working theory of what this might be.
The outrage engagement.
Outrage engagement.
I think that there might be something to it. We will talk about that later on because I have some thoughts about that as well. I do want to take a kind of a stroll through recent history and talk about some examples of where this adding social justice into your marketing came from, examples of it early on, and maybe look at some of the reasons why it's there.
Absolutely. And depending on where you start, I might want to go a little bit further back with the advertising history, just with some basics. But yeah, start it wherever you like and we'll fill it in.
So where I first noticed it at was when Gamergate happened, was the first time that it came to my attention. And for people that don't know about what Gamergate was, it started because there was a female game programmer, and she kept getting positive reviews from different journalists that were promoting her work. And a lot of the people that were buying it were saying, I don't see why she's getting, this game is garbage. I don't see why she got such glowing reviews. Then it came out that she was sleeping with at least two of the guys that had given her a glowing review on her video game. So fans started saying, or gamers started saying, hey, this is not ethical. You're giving her preferential treatment because you're sleeping with her, or you're giving her preferential treatment because she's a woman. And then the pushback was, well, you're not allowed to criticize her because she's a woman. And it started becoming a kind of a marketing thing. It started becoming, you have to buy it because she's a woman, or else you're a bigot, you're a misogynist. And that was my first introduction to identity politics starting to become part of marketing. I don't know if you are familiar of it being even further back.
No, not the identity politics stuff. I was just kind of like wondering why advertising took this direction. Yeah, I mean, I think there was a merger with like a lot of other cultural forces. And eventually, like you said, when you were talking about these young marketers getting involved in this Valentine's conversation. Yeah, I mean, social justice infiltrates everything. So here it is in this. But I think that the advertising world kind of made a space for it. There was a need with the understanding of like outrage culture and people in mass taking to the internet to complain about things and producing that kind of viral effect. I mean, a lot of people might not be able to put into words that the ire they feel about seeing these sort of things. I mean, the simplest concept to get your hands around is probably pandering. But also, like I've talked about historically, especially when it comes to issues of social justice, especially in the 1960s, the government saw a parade that they couldn't stop. They couldn't sick dogs on it. They couldn't beat it back with fire hoses. So they jumped in front of it and they pretended that they were leading it. And this is not like a dissimilar example. But I mean, traditionally, advertising, even if you go back to the days of Bernays, sure, there was some manipulation and preying on people's emotions in it, but it was about an appeal. And you talked about this too a few minutes ago, an appeal to like a customer avatar based on a customer need. And if it was a customer want, that was okay too. And when we were growing up, that was pretty much the style of advertising. There was some cleverness. There were some characters. There was certainly some comedy in television commercials. But it's just like, hey, you're this kind of person. You need this thing. A lot of marketing was that, right? So yes, this is for housewives who are frustrated with this problem. This thing solves it. I think that style got boring. And I think by the time, you know, we were teenagers, it was pretty easy to tune that kind of advertising out. Today, if people are still trying to advertise that way, it's never been easier to opt out of ads. You know, I mean, having the free version of Hulu and having to sit through 90 seconds of commercials is like an outrage these days. But that was 10 minutes of every half an hour of television when we were growing up. You know, if people are still listening to talk radio, it's like, yeah, I mean, it's pretty close to 50-50. And then I think our teen years, young adults, we started to see commercials become more artistic. Super Bowl commercials really spearheaded that. Commercials became more brazen, being about you. This gives you status, this gets you sex, until everything was just sex. And then people could kind of like tune that out in a lot of ways, unless it was like really over the top, like the Kate Upton, whatever that was, the Arby's commercial where she's eating some gross Arby's sandwich, or Carl's Jr. It was Carl's Jr. in a bikini. And then from there, when people are, you know, that doesn't work anymore, people get used to it. We saw some interesting trends over the last 10 or 15 years in kind of like absurdist advertising. I think like Geico did a pretty good job with that, where you're seeing ads that aren't even about the products anymore, right? They're not even, they have nothing to do with the benefits of the products. And I think that's actually the transition into what we've seen now, where it's like, oh, with the Geico cavemen, we don't need to talk about why this insurance is better than other. There doesn't even need to be an enticement with this product. It's just like it's putting the name out there and it's giving people a good time for 30 seconds to connect them to this brand. So everyone tried to get weird, and then nobody really cared about that anymore either. Like, people got used to that. I remember seeing this trend where corporations were being like really weird on Twitter, and maybe that's still going on, like Wendy's or Sunny Delight just tweeting really weird kind of eccentric things to get engagement. But then we started to see, also through Twitter and other forms of social media, boycotts, right? Do you remember the Keurig thing? People wanted to boycott Keurig because they pulled their ads from Hannity's show after. There's always these campaigns to like, advertisers should boycott Rush Limbaugh, advertisers should boycott, you know, Hannity or this Fox News program. And then there's a bunch of buzz about it on Twitter. I actually think that might have been the door opening a little bit to this kind of, let's kind of surf on this outrage advertising.
I think it was that. It was also, as we moved away from print media into digital media, and it started becoming about clicks, and outrage is what they found. The algorithm found that outrage is what gets a lot of shares. Oh, can you believe how crazy this is? And for a while there, we were having police brutality videos were just shared like crazy. They went viral. So there was entire, I mean, especially inside the libertarian community, things like Cop Watch and or Cop Block and similar websites started going viral, started being able to sell ad space. Then we had like a lot of the like BuzzFeed and some of those other types of, I guess, kind of like in the middle media. They're not quite mainstream, but they're not quite fringe media either. They started realizing, oh, these outrage things, police brutality gets a lot of shares. Racism gets a lot of shares. Well, what happens if we mix racism with police brutality? Oh, wow, we get extra shares.
Right.
What happens if we throw a transgender into the mix? And then you started seeing like these headlines, white police officer beats transgender black person within an inch of their life. And that gets the most shares of all. And then I think that there was that. And then the marketing departments, so it started kind of out in journalism, but the marketing departments were definitely paying attention. If something's working in journalism, it might work in marketing. And so what's grabbing people's attention in journalism? Well, let's figure out if we can kind of grift off of that, take what's working in journalism and inject it into our marketing. And so I think that that's a little bit of it. And then just the fact that a lot of these kids that are coming straight out of college from the marketing professors there, and going into these, you know, I've got my degree in marketing, I'm going to go get a job working for X, Y, and Z company. And they did learn marketing, but they also learned a bunch of intersectional feminism and anti-racism and all of these critical race theories. They're learning all of this in college along with marketing. And so they're coming into the marketing department and they're saying, well, let's inject some of this. It's working in journalism. Let's try it in the marketing. And the people that are running these companies are like, well, we're out of touch with the youth. We're going to trust you. And so I think that there's a couple of different reasons why this stuff has become as prevalent as it is. And maybe it worked at first, and we'll kind of talk about this, but I'm not sure that there's just one source. I think there's multiple different veins that kind of made its way into marketing to the point where we're at, where we're at today.
Right. So you had mentioned Gamergate, and there were some other early examples of this starting to pop up, right?
Yeah. So Gamergate was the first one. Comicsgate was in the comic book industry. And this might lead to what we're going to talk about later about whether this works or not, or what they say, get woke, go broke. Mm. Comicsgate, they started, gosh, I don't know, mid 2010s. They started replacing a bunch of the white male leads. They started saying, okay, Captain America is going to be a black guy now, and Thor is going to be a female now, and Incredible Hulk is going to be an Asian guy now. They started trying to diversify their main lineup of characters. Fans were not too happy with it. And there's arguments for both ways that I kind of agree with. But for me, it was kind of one of those things where it's just, hey, once I'm used to buying this particular product, if you make a drastic change to the product, I'm not going to enjoy it. An example for me that kind of goes the other way is I was a big fan of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comic books when I was a kid. And one of the main characters, Baxter Stockman, he was a black guy in the comics. And then when they made the cartoon, they made him a white guy. And it was so hard for me to wrap my brain around, oh, Baxter Stockman's a white guy in the cartoon. This isn't Baxter Stockman. So race swapping for a fan base that's already grown to love a character one way, to tell them, oh, now this is a totally different character. It's the same character, but it's a totally different character. It's hard for people who have already come to expect one thing to easily adopt the new thing. But because comic book readers were mad about it, they got called isms, sexism, racism, whatever. You started seeing these social justice tropes pop up. I think comic books was the first place where it hit hard. The strong, empowered female character trope, the bisexual coloring, which is like a lot of the comic books now have switched to pink and purple coloring. And then hiring based off of diversity checkboxes. We need to make sure we have this many females working on the editorial staff. We need to make sure that if a comic book is about a black character, we have a black person writing it or a black person drawing it, and not hiring based off of, are you good at your job? Do you care about these characters? Do you have good interaction with the fan base? It was just, can we check off a diversity checkbox with you? Okay, you're hired. From Comicsgate, we started seeing it. We're starting to see it work its way into television. A lot of the superhero TV shows now are getting woke. The Star Wars franchise has went super woke with their Forces female. Now we're seeing cancel culture kind of work its way into the entertainment. I mean, in the entertainment industry now, cancel culture is like the number one thing that's moving the decisions behind what should we make, what should we not make. And so it started out in these fringe things, video game culture, comic book culture, and now it's the prime force, the prime mover as far as decisions go, creativity wise, in almost every aspect of entertainment now.
It's directing production, because I think one of the things that has been pushed here is that it's no longer what you do say or what you did say. I mean, we'll get you for that too. We'll go back to 2009 if we need to. Like, if you're, you know, on an upward trajectory and experience a lot of success, we'll go find the thing you did wrong. Like, look what happened to Kevin Hart. And there are lots of other examples of that too. But after, I really think this was a phenomenon that started mid-2020 with the whole George Floyd thing. It does still matter what you do say. But now it also matters what you're not saying. So I think in these boardrooms, looking at like production ideas, it's like, well, we need to be doing something like this. We need to be doing something like that, even if it crowds out better content or better storytelling, right? And with the diversity hiring, I mean, yeah, maybe sometimes that works out fine. And maybe a Black character is written better by Black writers in certain ways. I mean, I don't think there's anything controversial about that. But if people are hired on like an agenda basis, they might, and just to another thing that draws upset from people who are fans, and we could get into Star Wars too if you want, people approach the canon with hostility. We want to change this. We want to disrupt this. In some cases, we want to ruin this, basically. I mean, I think it goes that far, is that this is a kind of sacred cow, maybe in some cases, or it's part of the culture and we want to destroy it or we want to make it our own.
Mm-hmm. We call it a culture war. And I think that's because there are cultural strong points in war. There's bridges that you need to take over. There's certain hills that you take over in order to gain the strategic advantage. In this, it's the same thing. There's properties that you want to take over. Oh, we own Spider-Man now, or we own Batman now, or whatever the case may be. I go back to comics because that's where I'm a comic book nerd. And let's kind of talk about this. I think that there's good aspects to this stuff. As a comic book fan, I want the community of people reading comic books to be as big and broad as possible. I want Black people reading comics. I want Hispanic people reading comics. I take Bella to the comic book store with me all the time because I encourage, she loves manga. She loves reading those type of comics. I want her to be reading. So I take her to the comic book store with me. I want her to be part of the community. I want it to be as inclusive as possible. I want it to be as accepted, as accepting as possible. And so I can see why these companies, Marvel Comics or DC Comics, would want it to be that same way as well. I could see why they would say, hey, we want more girls. We want more people of color, as they love to say. We want these different target demographics to come in and enjoy our products so we can make more sales. I get that. The problem is the tokenization. It comes off as very insincere. And then also we're going to hire this person based off of their skin color or their sexual identity instead of how much love they have for this character or how good they are at their job or how well they interact with the fan base. And so we get these people that, and not always, but more often than not, we get these people who are hired. They know that they're hired because of what they are rather than how they treat the customers or how good they are at their job. A lot of times they have a chip on their shoulder because they buy into a bunch of the victim narrative stuff and they're not good at their job. We didn't hire the best person for the job. We hired the person who fit the identity that we were looking for. And when customers say, hey, this isn't as good as when the last guy was writing this or the last girl was writing this, instead of taking that as constructive criticism, they take it as an attack. And that now we have to attack the fan base back. Oh, you don't like this? It's because you're sexist. It's because you're racist. We've seen a lot of that work its way into the marketing as well. It's you have to buy it or you're a sexist. And if you complain about it, you're a sexist. You have to buy it or you're a racist. And if you complain about it, you're a racist. And most of the time, it's false accusations. Ghostbusters 2016, the all-female Ghostbusters, most people just didn't like it because they said it was a garbage movie, but that wasn't the reason. The real reason they hated it is because they hated women.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So any criticism has to be channeled through the only like channel that these people are really given for evaluating anything, or at least the primary channel that kind of crowds out all the other channels, is that there's some kind of bigotry involved if you don't. What other explanation could there be for you not liking this thing? Well, again, it is like, I think so. So there's like a subtext here that most people just don't know how to put into words, right? Ghostbusters is a property. Ghostbusters is a landmark. Like Star Wars is a landmark. People see this, kind of knowing the agenda or the politics behind it, as an attack on this thing, but none of that can be formed into words. So people just see it and they go, I hate that. And then people hear them say, I hate that. And their only framing is, well, then you're sexist or you're racist. And it just, the conversation degrades almost from the start on these things, where no one can actually like step back and acknowledge that that culture war that you're talking about that's actually going on, and what these things mean. And I'm not saying that that would necessarily bring any understanding to it or any resolution to it, but people are having these conversations without even any precision in language. So you look at some of these outrage responses to woke advertising or wokenomics in the entertainment industry, you see a lot of silly mob behavior without anybody being able to articulate what's really bothering or why they're really doing what they're doing, why they're really responding the way they're responding.
Yeah. And from the marketing standpoint, a lot of times they're looking at their market and they're saying, oh, this market, especially if they're into these racial or gender identities, they're looking at this market and they're saying, this market has too much X. Let's try to get more Y into this marketplace. And so they do whatever they can to bring more Y into the marketplace. As the Y comes into the market, the Y says, well, we really don't like this part of this particular community. And this thing,
we really don't like diamonds. We're dudes. We really don't want to receive diamonds. Thanks for thinking of us, but we don't want them.
Yeah. Well, then that must mean that diamonds are homophobic. So it's we bring in people who just aren't attracted to this market, and they tell us all the reasons that they don't like it. They tell us all the reasons that they find it problematic. Now we're going to try and change everything about this culture, everything about this market, to make it more inclusive for the Y people. But the Y people were never interested anyway. So it's a phantom audience. They don't want to buy it. Even though you change everything, the majority of that, of the Y people, they're not interested. If they were, they would have come in the first place. And the ones of Y who did come in beforehand, they liked it the way that it was too. But by changing it to accommodate the Ys, we've demonized all the X's. We've called all the X's ists and phobes and bigots, and we've told them everything that they enjoyed about this community was problematic and horrible and made them horrible people. And so now we have this community, whether it's comic book fans, Star Wars fans, video game fans, now we have this community where we've tried to make it more inclusive. We've brought in a bunch of people who never really were interested. In order to get them, we pushed out all of the people who were interested, and now we have a bunch of people, all the people who were interested have left, and all the people who we brought in are just not interested in spending money, and inevitably it leads to a major collapse. And that's what we've seen. Comic books, the industry of comic books has completely collapsed over the last 12 months. Star Wars is having a civil war right now between the original fans and the pro-feminist, the Forces female fans. Video games, we see the video game culture completely divided right now. And all of these industries, again, market to the people that have headaches. If you sell Advil, don't try and bring in people who have never had headaches to expand your market base.
So in this example that you gave, or this model that you gave, the market is too much X, let's get more Y. Geez, not to sound like a person who needs to go to a re-education camp, but you break the cultural cohesion of whatever that thing is, right? There's some expectation, there's some trust, predictability, right? Some comfort, there's a language. And by trying to make it all things to all people, you break it. You break it. This is the idea behind get woke, go broke, right? Whether people actually go broke or not, I don't have lots of examples of that, but we can talk about that. But maybe part of it is this project of a cultural takeover. We're going to claim these institutions or these symbols or these brands as our own for whatever reason, as a sign of a changing of the way things are. but it's also, I guess in some cases, fumbling by people who are maybe with good intentions in some cases, trying to be more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. As far as Get Woke, Go Broke, it became kind of a meme because it did happen a lot. DC Comics and Marvel Comics went woke and they ended up going broke. Both of them, DC is on the chopping block from AT&T right now, as far as the print comics go, because they're just not making enough money. And Marvel Comics, Disney is saying the same thing. If the comic books don't start selling more, we're just going to cut the print. We saw with Gillette lost something like $8 billion after they ran that Men Should Be Better, the toxic masculinity ad that they ran in the middle of last year. Maybe it was the year before. They, in that quarter, they saw an $8 billion loss in revenue. And maybe it wasn't all because of that, but there was a huge backlash from people from that commercial. And there is a lot of these woke journalism outlets, BuzzFeed and all of these outlets that were making a lot of money back when the algorithm was favoring the outrage stuff. They're going under left and right now. A lot of these journalist outlets that went woke in 2016 are going broke in 2020, 2021. So there is some evidence to indicate that getting woke does lead most companies to either lose a lot of money or just go broke and go bankrupt. But there's also the argument the other way. Maybe the comic book industry was already in decline because comic books just aren't selling in the digital age the way that they did when there was less forms of entertainment to choose from. And going woke was a result of the fact that they were already going broke. They were losing money and they said, well, what can we do? Oh, well, the kids are really into social justice, or social justice is what everybody's, that's what is getting attention on social media. So maybe it was for some of these industries, it's, oh, we're going broke, let's try and go woke as a way to gain some market relevance again, or kind of kick the can down the road. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I'm not sure. I think that there's reason for discussion on both ends, get woke, go broke, or possibly, hey, we're going broke, let's get woke as a way to try and turn this around and appeal to the younger buyers with money in their pockets.
Perhaps because, you know, more traditional forms of advertising are getting worn out too, which could be, you know, the downfall of any company that relies on, you know, this kind of promotion of brand awareness too. So Pepsi didn't take much of a hit, even from the Kendall Jenner thing. Like, that was not a huge loss from them. I think Nike did fairly well with the, so there's examples both ways is what I'm saying. Nike did fairly well with the whole Kaepernick controversy. There was boycott Nike, burn your Nikes. That's what people were doing. They're burning, you know, their shoes on Twitter. And I don't know. I mean, I just see that as people being, that's why I was so suspicious of this thing you were talking about in Clubhouse. I just see all of these unwitting people being recruited as guerrilla advertisers for brand awareness. Right. And then they're trying to punish the corporation with free advertising. Nike's in the quarter that Nike did the Kaepernick thing, their sales went up 30%. Right. Now, maybe there are brands that could weather a temporary bad PR storm of a bunch of people behaving foolishly on Twitter. Right. While hashtagging the name of the company over and over and over again until it trends. I don't know. But 2017, Pepsi's brand image improved. They basically lost nothing, even with all the outrage about, you know, caricaturing BLM. Now, customers want this. I think people want these ads just to hate them, you know, because of that outrage culture that is on both sides of the so-called political spectrum. And, you know, the psychographic data, we talked about this in the mass contagion experiment show, which was mostly about Facebook and Cambridge, and a lot of it had to do with like Cambridge Analytica. The psychographic data that's available on the average consumer today through their behavior on social media or on Google alone allows these brands entirely novel ways of getting inside people's heads. And it's so much more than just wants and needs now. It's almost like there's an engineering of these kinds of outrage-driven and tribalizing conversations over these types of ads done by companies that have terrible reputations as far as how they actually treat people. Nike, slave labor, Apple, people jumping out of windows of factories, Amazon.com, one of the biggest promoters of this kind of stuff in recent years, systematizing anti-unionization amongst their workers. They're not treating people well. So there's a lot of hypocrisy here that I think that people, when they see this pandering, they say, well, wait, you're really not a good company. You're really not doing good things as far as like the people you could most directly impact. You're not helping them. So stop bullshitting us with this. I think that's part of it too. I think that's part of what upsets people. But people are ads. I mean, people are ads. We were talking about this in the university in a call. There, I remember that episode of South Park with like PC Principal, and there's the girl, Leslie, and they're like trying to study her, and they're like, oh my God, she's an ad. People are basically just ads at this point for one thing or another, whether it's a political or a social agenda, and sometimes they can be recruited to do it for brands.
That kind of leads into a whole different can of worms, but as far as your example of Nike goes and Pepsi, I think Pepsi, it was just kind of like everybody who looked at it just kind of groaned. They did the face palm thing and they said that was really in bad taste. Nike knew its market. Nike knew that 9 out of 10 people that buy Nike shoes are probably in favor of what Kaepernick was doing, probably buy into this whole narrative. Even the majority of the white people who buy Nike shoes are probably very sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter narrative. So Nike taking that stand, they knew that they would not be throwing stones at their own audience by taking that stand, or at least they would be throwing stones at less than 1/10 of their audience, and they would really solidify the other 9/10. Gillette was the opposite. Gillette was an example of them throwing stones at their own audience. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about, if you want people on your side, you pick an enemy and you throw stones at the enemy. A lot of this social justice marketing, occasionally with Nike, it's a good example of that. They picked an enemy that their audience saw as an adversary, and they threw stones at it. But a lot of times it's throwing stones at the audience themselves. A lot of times this social justice stuff is just a chance for the activists to get up on TV and tell the consumer to be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, Gillette was probably the one that made me the most suspicious, right? Because it was like, wait a minute, this is your entire market and you're attacking them. Yeah. So I looked into the story a little bit and I found this quote from Gillette's North America brand director. This was on CNN Business. His name was Pankaj Bala. He said, "We expected debate. Actually, a discussion is necessary," right? So to me, like, again, being cynical, this is just total bullshit. We expected a whole bunch of nitwits to go and fight about this online is what he's saying, right? If we don't discuss, don't talk about it, I don't think real change can happen, unquote. Because the scourge of toxic masculinity, it's like Gillette, they can barely even run the production lines over there because everybody's so worried about it. It's bullshit. That campaign was about driving outrage. I don't know what else it was about. I don't see it another way, but tell me why I'm wrong if you think so.
I don't think that you're wrong. I think for a lot of the reasons that we discussed, I don't think it was just one reason why they ran it. I think that there was multiple things. I think that, again, they saw that that's what type of conversation was getting engagement on social media. The woman that they hired to write and produce that ad is a hardcore feminist. She did a women's empowerment commercial for another Johnson & Johnson brand. And that one did really well because it was for a woman. It was for a female audience. And so the commercial was all about, you can do this. It was uplifting, empowering, talking about all the great aspects of being a female. And that's makes perfect sense. If you're writing an ad for a mostly female market, uplift female, empower them, make them feel like, hey, by buying my product, you can be your best you. You can live your best life. Then having the same anti-male, pro-female agenda for a male market, I think it was a bad call. Like I said, in the quarter after that hit $8 billion loss in profits, the math kind of favors me believing it was a bad call.
So in the lessons that we can take out of this, like to help people with their own branding, with their own marketing, and I think their own general awareness about these kinds of things, I wanted to just pose this question to you. You and I have both been in like alternative media, we'll call it, for a long time, right? We first encountered each other 9 years ago. You were doing your show, I was doing my show. Did you ever feel like you were trying to be too many things to too many people?
Yes. My show has gone through different iterations. It's been canceled and rebooted and taken on different faces.
Self-canceled. Yeah. The old-fashioned canceled.
Yes, I feel like I have done a lot of trying to be too much to too many different people, specifically trying to integrate freedom and liberty, that messaging with business ownership. Sometimes, and it's hard because I keep going back to it because they're two things that I'm very passionate about. But yeah, I definitely have tried to market. I'll say this, inside of the freedom community, there is a large amount of people who don't actually want freedom. They just want to complain about stuff.
They want to find examples of not freedom.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I'm all about finding examples of freedom, finding ways to find freedom. And one of those is self-business or business ownership, self-employment. For me, it's kind of like a no-brainer that those things should go together. But my experience has been there's a lot of people in the freedom community that don't want actual freedom, and or maybe business ownership or working themselves out of debt or out of poverty is not what equals freedom to them. Instead, freedom to them equals being able to yell at a cop with a bullhorn. So yes, long answer short, yes.
Yeah. And I mean, I asked because that's been my situation as well. My show has survived for almost 12 years with no ideal client avatar. I could make 3 or 4 or 5 for what we've done and the content that we've covered. And it was just too broad. And in the early days, as the audience grew, I really had to pause, not in a healthy or a helpful way, and say, well, how can I accommodate these people too? Because if they're here, they should be here, right? So how do I make them happy too? And it actually changed the course of what I was doing in a lot of ways. Now, we've managed to do okay, but if I had been speaking to like a really specific group of people this entire time, I think we could have had more success. By trying to go after a smaller group of people, we could have actually had a more involved, more engaged type of audience, right? I think I was trying to be inclusive, ironically, especially considering how I talk now so much, when I needed to be more exclusive, which is what you would say marketing is really all about.
Yeah. And so the three reasons why I'm against inclusive marketing, all the way back to the beginning of the show, let's try and figure out how we can get gay guys to buy diamonds for their male fiancés, or I don't know what that would be. Yeah, sure. There's three main reasons why I am not a fan of this inclusive social justice woke marketing. The first one is what you just mentioned. Marketing is not supposed to be inclusive. Marketing is supposed to be intentionally exclusive. The one thing I hate when I sit down with a new client and I ask them, who's this product or service for? And they say, well, it's for everybody. If that's their answer, most of the time I just walk away. I'm just like, yeah, you're not at the point where I can do anything for you yet. If you can tell me it's for males in this industry between this age and this age who have these goals, who have been burnt by this particular product in the past, who are skeptical because of this, and they spend their days doing this, and these are their values, you've just excluded 98% of the market out there, and you've narrowed down the 2% that you want to go after. I can write an amazing sales page for you. But if you tell me, oh, we're for everybody, then I'm not going to be able to write a good sales page for you. So marketing is not supposed to be inclusive. If you sell engagement diamonds that men are supposed to spend 3 months of their salary on to make their beautiful wife happy and feel like she made the right decision by saying yes, you don't go after transgendered people. You don't go after lesbian couples. You don't go after gay couples. On the other hand, if your market is lesbian couples, you exclude the straight couples. You exclude the gay couples. You only go after the lesbians. So marketing shouldn't be inclusive. It should never be for everybody. The other thing is, when they do this, a lot of times it's not actually inclusive. It's inclusive to everybody except for the majority. And a lot of times it's like in the Gillette commercial, it's inclusive to everybody except for the people we're actually trying to sell to. So all of the beta males with low testosterone who can't grow a beard anyways, we're going to make a commercial to try and sell razors to them. And we're going to all the high testosterone guys who their beard is full and it's bushy and they need it. They need our product. We're going to throw rocks at them. Like, that's ridiculous. Same thing with comic books. If the majority of your readers are nerdy guys that want to see heroes and attractive women in their comics, and you start throwing stones at them to be more inclusive to other people, you start excluding your target market. So they say inclusive, but what they usually mean is, how can we push away the people who are already buying it in order to try and bring in a bunch of people who aren't buying it? That's not inclusivity. Demonizing the target market to be more attractive to other people is not inclusive. Inclusive means the target market plus these other people, not the target market is eliminated at the expense of these other people. And then the last thing, the last reason why I'm really against most of this woke marketing, and this is just a personal preference to me, I'm going to do it with the preference that it's going to make me sound like an asshole. Most of these people that are into all of these social justice, identity politics, they're college kids just out of college with a whole bunch of debt, or they're mid-30s and mid-40s liberals who have not accomplished much in their life, so they're looking for other people to blame. It's the patriarchy's fault that I'm poor. It's the white people's fault that I'm being held back. It's this group's fault that I'm not where I wish I could be in life. Most of these people are anti-capitalist. They've been brainwashed into hating capitalism. They're still very poor, so they don't have a very good disposable income, and they're kind of losers. They just want to blame other people. So for me personally, broke losers, anti-capitalist broke losers is not a demographic that I want to try and get money out of in the first place. So I do everything in my market to exclude people who might fall into these demographics. If you're an anti-capitalist Marxist, cultural Marxist, fighting the patriarchy, fighting systemic oppression type of person, I don't want to try and squeeze money out of you anyways. So I'm definitely not going to participate in woke marketing because I don't want to attract that type of demographic.
There is, I would also say, a bit of a contingent that I'm realizing exists, that the sort of cosmopolitan people who are our age, who do have decent amounts of money, who will do absolutely anything that the orthodoxy tells them to do. I see these people in cities. I've been seeing a lot of this lately, like wherever you go to a neighborhood where the houses are $50,000, $60,000 more than the average home price in the entire metro area, right? So people have money there, but every single one of them, not every single one of them, but there are plenty of the yard signs, in this house we believe, this platitude, that platitude, that platitude, one after the other. All different versions of this, gentrified white neighborhoods where everyone has Black Lives Matter signs. You go to the grocery store, people are standing in line for food. That's the policy here. Due to COVID, we stand in line for food. To go into this grocery store, we stand in a line with our heads down, staring at our phones with our mask or two on. And that's how we behave now because that's what we've been told, right? So it's very much about, so these are actually people who are about spending money because appearance requires the spending of money, right? Virtue signaling is about appearance, if nothing else. So there are people to market this way too. But I do see an insidiousness to this where it's like, spark a debate, spark outrage, get brand awareness out there that way, because, you know, that's the way the wind blows right now. So I think that's a big part of it as well. But it also reveals that there's, like, when you're going through the reasons why you think inclusive marketing fails or why you're against it, it also shows a real degradation in the dialogue. Because these people come out of college, and this has been true for 20 years, so there's people who came out of college with these ideas and never challenged them, so now they're our age. But they would say, well, you know, all right, so imagine you went to this Clubhouse thing. And you're listening to this conversation and you chime in and go, yeah, well, marketing's supposed to be exclusive. Marketing's not supposed to be inclusive. Imagine the reaction that you would get from some of these young people who would say, oh, no, everything is supposed to be inclusive. Right? That's the dogma. Everything needs to be inclusive. And then you go, OK, well, then don't you feel like if Gillette's, you know, ideal client avatar is men who are maybe white and this age, oh, not them, not including them, just including everybody. Like, that's the degradation, right? So it's inclusion without question, diversity without question. If you ask these people, like, why is diversity good? Or the subtle racism and prejudice in, like, we need more black people here. At, like, a college campus, like Thaddeus Russell talked about this all the time. We got to get more blacks in here, right? For the benefit of the white students. What is the prejudging of black people this college has? Like, what is the expectation that you're putting on black people coming here? What are they supposed to do for you when they get here, right? It's so prejudice. It's so prejudice. And like Thad also explained how racial liberalism or this paternalism was just transferred from, you know, like, geez, can we sterilize these people? And the thing that changed it was the Nazis, right? After the Nazis, it's like, all right, well, we can't talk about, like, sterilizing them anymore. So let's just act like we're their parents and try to help them. You know, it's like the only impulse is to control everything anyway in society and culture. So this idea of inclusion and diversity hires is so prejudiced because it's putting expectations on people you don't even know based on what they look like, right? It's the definition of prejudice that all these people are doing. So if you ask these people, what's good about diversity? What's good about inclusion? Their heads just explode because they don't know the answer. They do not know the answer, right? It is such a religious belief, but they do know that it doesn't apply to traditionally privileged groups. The groups they see as true, well, fuck them. We don't mean include. All inclusion is good. All diversity is good, but not for those people. Not the diversity of their ideas or their needs. So it's just the plot is completely lost on this. And I thought, you know, unless Gillette, which I think I am suspicious that it was to have that viral outrage appeal, but if it was with good intentions just based on these faulty premises, I mean, that's a sign of the times of how bad things have actually gotten, right? Where there's no precision in language with this anymore at all. So if these marketing departments are by and large populated today by these kids that you're interacting with in these Clubhouse meetings, great. There's still people above them looking at bottom lines going, yeah, go out there with your dumb ideas and stir some shit to help our bottom line. You know, I think those two things could definitely work together.
Well, and what I've seen is a lot of times especially now it's not just Clubhouse. I work with a lot of, over the last 5 years, I've worked with marketing departments from everywhere from Sirius Satellite Radio to some of the bigger name multinational companies that I'm not even through NDA. I'm not even allowed to say who they are, but I've worked with some very big companies and I've seen this permeate and kind of work its way into the marketing departments across the board. But now what I'm starting to see is where this is kind of like, it's almost done as a tax. It's we have the marketing that goes at the marketing that we know works that goes after this, but we also have the marketing that we basically lose money on, the get woke, go broke marketing. We're going to do it because we're going to appease the people that will come after us and attack us if we don't. We spend 70% of our advertising on what we know works, and we spend 30% of our advertising deliberately on something that we know doesn't work just to appease the religious fanatics or the tax collectors. They're going to come after us if we don't spend the 30%. So we're going to make sure we allocate that. And the best example that I can give for this is the WB DC series that they have, like the Arrowverse. There's Arrow, there's The Flash, they have Batwoman. They keep renewing Batwoman, and they kept renewing Supergirl, even though the ratings were plummeting. They couldn't sell advertising because there wasn't enough people watching. They kept renewing them just to appease the woke mob. It was a tax that they were paying.
Like a loss, instead of a loss leader, it's like a loss appeaser.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's basically like paying a tax to the woke religion, the woke government, the woke mob will do 70% of our programming that we know people will actually consume and we can actually sell advertising on. And then we'll deliberately spend 30% of our budget on something that we know we're going to lose money on, but we're just going to see it as a tax. It's a way to appease the tax collectors so that they don't come after us and shut our entire business
down. It is like dealing with the actual fucking mob, because that's what they do, right? Like if you're a pizza, you know, you're a pizza parlor owner in some place where organized crime controls, you have to set aside money to pay protection money to, you know, La Cosa Nostra every month. This has almost become like a form of organized crime.
Yeah. And I think that's a little too on the nose, but I think, yes, it has become a form of organized crime.
So before we still have a few people or some people watching us, I just posted the link to our meeting here in the University Discord. So if anybody wants to jump in with a question in a minute, we will open that mic. But before we do that, today's show was about advertising. Our previous installment in this series was about the creation of narratives, basically to manipulate mass opinion. Before that, we talked about tribalism, which is kind of a similar topic. Before that, we talked about social media. Before that, we talked about behaviorism. We talked about, in the previous show, fear-mongering. And in the one before that, marketing, 27 words to make the world do your bidding. So in this series so far, we've spent a lot of time on what we could call external programming. And you and I have been talking behind the scenes about putting together a kind of training, a kind of course, and a community on deprogramming, not only from these external things, which are really, really important. And a lot of our work has gone this way in various forms for a long time, especially at School Sucks Project, but also various types of internal programming. So you and I have actually started to put together a curriculum that we're going to be launching within the next couple months. And I just wanted to throw to you to share anything you want to about that at this point.
Yeah, so I feel sometimes hypocritical, sometimes conflicted. I spend about half of my time teaching business owners how to use these influence and persuasion and sometimes manipulation tactics in order to grow their business. I also spend the other half of my time and energy trying to teach people how not to be susceptible to these influence, persuasion, and sometimes manipulative tactics. So I kind of feel like I feed both dogs inside of me. But I really am interested in taking what we've done on these episodes to a little bit higher of a level. We've talked a lot about the external stuff, the way that politicians manipulate you, the way that marketers manipulate you, the way a lot of times you've done on your podcast, the way that state institutions manipulate people. I want to do something where we can teach people how to quickly identify and build defenses against that stuff, but also a lot of the things that we do to manipulate ourselves, a lot of the stories that we tell ourselves that keep us from going out and applying for the better position, or from asking out the girl that we're you know, head over heels over, but we're too intimidated by, or starting the business that we know would be a great business, but we're telling ourselves all these stories that prevent us from doing it, or even as far as eating better and taking better care of our health, but all these stories that I have low metabolism or I have a thyroid issue. These different things. There's programming outside of us that keeps us from living our best lives. There's programming inside of us that keeps us from living our best lives. And there's very simple ways, once you're able to identify these programs, there's very simple ways to rewrite these programs and start getting the most out of your own life. And that's what I'm interested in, is helping people do that third step. Of course, we have to walk people through the first two steps to get there. But yeah, I hit you up and we both got really excited about this, and we've been working in the background and the more we put into it, the more excited I am about it.
Yes. So
in the very near future, we will be letting people know how they can get involved with this, but I'm super excited about it. And that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah. And I mean, I really am starting to see this as the culmination of all the work that I've been doing for the past decade, is to build a supportive community like we have with the university. This would be separate from that. The two will exist simultaneously for me, but to be able to build some accountability, some ongoing training, some ways that people can work together and work with us, really identifying this as kind of a vicious cycle too. Like, we're subjected from this very early age to these forms of external programming that happen in family, that certainly happen in schools. And then that contributes to the external programming, right? Well, the things we get from various types of authority figures and sources of authority, that becomes an inner voice that can inhibit us in lots of ways. And that inhibited inner voice or inner resourcefulness can actually in turn make us more susceptible to other types of external programming as they continue, right? There are finishing schools for school, right? The things that people see on television. Now, there's lots of people in my audience who go, oh, I get this. I'm not susceptible to that. And I would agree, I'm not either. But that doesn't mean that I'm not still running harmful or limiting internal programs of my own, even after doing this work for so long. And I said to myself, and I've learned from talking to people in my community and meeting hundreds and hundreds of people in my audience over just the last 5 years, that lots of other people are still struggling with these things too. So I think to be able to build a training, a curriculum around this that has visibility and support, and probably most importantly, as far as growth is concerned, accountability, is the greatest finish to the work that I've been doing for almost 12 years at this point. So I'm really, really excited about the development of this, and we will be announcing more about it soon. So if you enjoy Emotional Manipulators for Hire, that is just a tiny taste, I think, of what this whole comprehensive program will be.
Absolutely. And I think with that, we should call it a show. Oh, Nicholas is raising his hand. I'm going to invite him in as a panelist real quick. Welcome.
So a thing that I'm curious about, and I'm curious if it relates to marketing the same as it does, say, what the study was actually on, which was music. And part of the idea is that essentially if you hear a song three times, you like that song. You begin liking it because psychologically the familiarity worms into your brain, so you start. So is the idea of all the marketing working on perhaps the next group of people that they want to bring into the fold? And if they keep, you know, dotting and peppering the current marketing with this future casting marketing, is the way I think of it, is the idea that they're going to eventually kind of bring it into the social consciousness and will it to be so? Is there any studies on that you're aware of, out of curiosity?
I know that just in branding in general, it's not as quick as with songs. I have seen the studies about songs three times and they start becoming a earworm for you. With branding, I think the minimal touch point they say is 27. So you need to see something 27 times, interact with it 27 times before it starts becoming something that you are familiar or relate with.
No, that actually kind of answers my question. Like, it was, I was curious if there was any kind of correlation between, like, you know, the art of advertising versus the art of music, where, you know, there is a certain point at which it just kind of starts affecting you, manipulating you to kind of go along with what it is. And it sounds like your answer is, yeah, if you get somebody in front of it 27 times, it might eventually start doing its thing on you. But that's also a big ask in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and I think that, again, it's who's susceptible to this. I know that my stepdaughter, she's 11 years old now. She is much more susceptible to these ideas. We talk about this stuff and I ask her, I question her, and I probe her to actually explain her beliefs about these things. But she's much more susceptible to this type of social justice advertising than I think people in our age range are. I think there's a lot more pushback from people who grew up in the 80s and 90s than there is from people who were born after the year 2000.
This reveals even more like cause for suspicion for me too. That fact, you need to touch something 27 times, as far as like viral outrage marketing is concerned, how many times is Tucker Carlson going to say Gillette the week that the Gillette thing happens, right? How many times is a person going to see that on Facebook or see that on Twitter? You get 27 touches in a day that way. So, I mean, using that kind of strategy, it's multi-level, like most things. There's people at the top who say, yeah, let these useful idiots in the middle work their magic as far as, like, you know, doing their socially conscious bullshit, and we'll rake in the rewards.
I mean, historically speaking, whatever they've been doing has been working. So.
Exactly. Right.
I'm going to push back on that, though.
Okay.
Just because, just like I said, with Gillette losing $8 billion and Disney after the Gina Carano thing, Disney is worried now. And even I think it was Forbes wrote an article about how financially negative the impact from firing Gina Carano off of The Mandalorian was as far as subscriptions being canceled.
By the way, they'd have lost even more if Verizon didn't give you it automatically with your cell phone.
Yeah.
I would have canceled if I paid for it.
Yeah, exactly. So there is this Star Wars is the movies is a great example too. Each movie did worse in this last franchise or in this last trilogy to the point where the last one actually lost money and has ate up a lot of goodwill with the majority of its fan base.
In particular, in the Gina Carano situation, the polls that they did, which I think was a Rasmussen poll, 75% of Disney's people were pissed off that they did it. Like, it made everybody angry. But that's also with Disney. You're also talking about people who, for some reason, continue to keep doing the wrong thing over and over and over again, like trying to brush away the whole Uyghur thing with Mulan. Yeah. Like, it's just, they can't escape controversy for some reason.
That's an awareness of future markets too, though, with that example.
Oh, I know.
So it kind of speaks to what you're saying, is that it might just be about cultural permeation in a longer game. And, you know, to Nathan's point, it might just be a worn out strategy. I mean, that could be part of it. Like when you start to see, it worked for Star Wars in 2017, but not in 2020. Right.
To be clear, it didn't do that. It has never actually worked for Star Wars.
Well, it didn't work with Episode 7.
No. It's been bad the whole way through.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been bad as far as like quality of cinema is concerned.
I think out of the only one that has anyone that likes it out of the new Star Wars movies was
Rogue One.
Yeah. Rogue One's the only one that feels positive, because they both sides feel like they're getting gypped in the movie. Even in the last one where they kind of pivoted back to the fans, all of their new fans hate it because they felt like it was too much fan service and not enough social justice.
Yeah. It's like, I know I should never try to speak for people of color, but this kind of came up in one of our meetings the other day. I don't understand how like Black people, Native American people aren't just going, geez, do white people ever shut the fuck up?
Well, they
so
are.
Annoying. Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of factors in play, but I appreciate you, shedding light on that, Nathan, the way you did today. And I appreciate the question, Nikki. Anything else before we wrap up?
Nothing that I'll have to talk to Nathan about outside of this.
Do you guys know each other?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, good. I was going to say, you two guys should know each other if you don't.
He was on Sounds Like Liberty way back in the day, and I really want to get him on Peace Freak Sexual. I was going to talk to him about. I want to know the ins and outs of being a dad with face tattoos and a professional.
We could set something up. Brett, do you mind giving Nick the opportunity to plug what his project is?
Oh, no, not at all. Go for it.
Anyone who doesn't know, I'm Nick. I host a podcast with my POC wife, Lizzie, called Peace Freaks. It's a podcast dedicated to the weird, freaky, nerdy, geeky people out there who want to upgrade their lives, but don't want to give up who they are to do it.
Awesome. Awesome. Nice. And Nikki was on episode 600 of School Sucks. We did a Sounds Like Liberty episode together, and I posted it as my 600 episode, and it was one of my favorite shows. Even though it is hard to talk about your own tastes in a way, for me, that I was listening, I listened back to it. I was like, does this sound pretentious to talk like this? But I really enjoyed the conversation. I don't get to talk about music enough.
What's funny is you say it sounds pretentious, but everyone who like there is a small but very loyal subset of people that just love hearing people geek out about their taste in music.
That's I figured that there was
I love every Tom Woods music episode he's ever put out.
Wait, Tom Woods does music episodes?
Well, I mean, they're just him geeking out at progressive rock, and he usually has his one friend on that's certainly into it too. But they're usually bonus episodes on the weekends when he does them.
Yeah. I know it's weird to think about like your own taste in music and go, wait a minute, doesn't everybody know this? Well, like I always felt like my taste in music was like pretty basic, and it's like, oh, these must be the things that everybody knows. So I remember listening back to, I think it was my perspective where I was like, everybody must know what I know about music. So,
well, you do good to try and pepper in your tastes into your show too. Mm-hmm. Every now and again, I hear something like, oh, I haven't heard that in a while. That's a good one. But I also assume Andrew's like feeding you stuff to put in there based on some of the stuff that gets in there.
More and more, but I'm actually like taking on more and more of his taste too. You know, the more time we spend.
Every time I hear a ska song, I'm like, yep, that's Andrew.
Yep, that's usually true.
I always love when like these episodes where I've already gone through the conversation and I know what we're going to talk about. And then you play a song at the beginning of the episode and I'm like, wow, that's perfect for what we're about to talk about. I'm not able to make those connections, but every time I hear you do it, I'm just like, how did he find that song?
Of all the shit that I forget, the one thing that I can just keep in my memory for some reason is like lyrics and just like trying to connect. I mean, I always try to be indirect, I guess, and make people think about why it's there. So yeah, it's just like knowing a good lyric or two helps with that a lot. And I don't know why I remember that and forget so much other shit. I've got this Evernote where I could go through it and be like, wow, I never knew that. Oh wait, yeah, I did, because I put this in here. But the music just seems to stick. Moods, lyrics, those kinds of things. So I appreciate that. But yeah, we'll wrap this one up. And for people who are interested, I'm sure Nathan and I will be updating you more soon on our developing new project.
All right. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And thank you, Nick, for coming on and adding to it.
Nathan, you've got stuff to plug too.
FMS Mastermind is where you can connect with me. And it's only for people that are interested in either starting their own business or growing their current business. That would be the only thing that I really want to plug right now.
Absolutely. And I'll just say my website is schoolsucksproject.com. You can find us as School Sucks Podcast on any podcatcher. Download the show if you've never heard it, you know, outside of the stuff that I've done with Nathan. I would say listen to three episodes. Give us three episodes. Search our archives. Look for topics that you're interested in, and hopefully you'll become a listener.
Awesome. Until next time, man.
All right. Take care. Yeah. Take these walls and rip them down. Take my and slip them now.
I'm so scared to put myself so out there. Time is running out, yeah. Need to let you know.